Leaves her students, her lectures, and her computer behind to visit the Mind Fluid, a Buddhist retreat house in a remote part of Wales. There's no telephone, no electricity, and no talking. Now she breaks with tradition to speak to some fellow regulars at the retreat, more usually, a place of silence.
It's very difficult to say what this place means to me. It's all bound up with sitting and looking at a white wall. You know the ordinary world that you're used to is out there somewhere, but it's quite remote. No one's going to come near you. There's no phone to ring. That isolation is very much a part of what it means to me. But I think if you ever do really hard mental work on yourself, if you do meditation, if you think about the mind and you sit there with yourself and who you are or aren't and what it's all about, the place you're doing it in somehow gets into you. And this is an ideal place for that. It's bleak, it's dark, it's windy, it's very often cold. And that somehow suits the hard work that you're doing sitting there. To get up to the house, you have to drive through a farmyard, Philip Wilson's farmyard. It's the last point of contact with the world, in a way.
I've known it ever since Dr. Crook came there, you know, and he's explained to me basically what they're doing, and I understand, and people locally look at it a little bit, you know, a different way, what's going on, and I explain to them a little bit, and they understand.
What do you think they think, then?
Well, they see them, of course, running around in the field sometimes, yeah. And they look at this and think, what's it doing? And I remember a story, there was two gentlemen over there who was fencing for us. And one or two of them come out straight out of the house. They run around the yard screaming and run straight back in. And the bloke was stood there with a mallet above his head like this, and he said, if one comes near me, I'll hit him straight on top. people hear tales like that, you know, and then they think, well, it's not right.
Well, what do you think they are doing? I mean, I sometimes wonder what we're doing up there. How would you describe it?
Well, like Dr. Crook said to me, most people have problems mount on them. They have problem after problem, and they get in such a tiz that they don't know which way they're going. And like he said, there's only one problem, and if you can clear the people's mind and he can get to that one single problem, everything else falls into place. And what I can understand, like, well, nobody's the same, everybody's different. And he said it takes different ways to clear people's mind. Some people need to run and scream to release it to clear their mind. Other people just need to sit down and slow down, and then they'll clear their mind to get to the root of the problem.
Sometimes I think, you know, what am I doing? It's such hard work and such agony sometimes, those retreats, and yet I keep on coming back.
Well, I noticed that a lot of people keep coming back, and they're from all walks of life. I remember we were shearing here one day, and we hamstringed the lamb. Accidentally tailing and hamstringed it, and Dr. Crook was there, and out come three actual doctors, and two of them were surgeons, and quite well to do, and handed this lamb to the doctor. Said, "You like them to have a look at it?" And I said, "Well, by all means." And they had a look at it, and they come out with their medical bags and everything, and their half-cut glasses, you know, and they carried on, and they stitched it all up and sutured the hamstring back together, put a splint on the lamb and let it go outside. And
wonderful. And you could just let it go then with its splint.
Well, let it go back to its mother then, obviously.
Right, yeah.
So to stay with it. And the lamb came, so amazingly.
Yeah. Do people ever leave the retreats and not manage to stick it out?
I get one or two. One left on Saturday. One night I was chatting to him as he came through the yard with his pack on his back, and he was an Irish boy, actually, and we had a chat, and he said himself, it was something, he doesn't think that he was ready for it. That was his way. He thinks maybe in 12 months' time I can come back and I can do it. But now, at the moment, he said, I couldn't handle it.
Oh, that's interesting.
They're very rare, far and few between the ones that do leave, but this is the odd one.
Because I've often been in this situation, sort of halfway through thinking, I must be mad. Why did I let myself in for this? But people don't leave on the whole, and they see that through, that sort of crisis.
It's a major change for a lot of people. You know, they've come from, most of the people come from big inner cities, where their lifestyle is fast and furious, all modern amenities, everything they need. They go to the Maslet, which is set in the bottom of a hill, which is isolated. There's no electricity. There's no television. There's no burger bar around the corner, you know, and some of them think it's just too much of a change. But he needs that to get them away from what they've been in, you know.
One of the many people who's been here on retreats with me lots of times is Simon Childs. Unfortunately, wasn't sure I'd recognise him, because on retreats you're not only not supposed to talk to people, but you're not even meant to look at them. So you just go around looking at their feet and bowing when they walk past.
More or less by chance, I went to a talk by John about the retreats. I went along with somebody else I didn't know what I was going to, and so I got interested and got a bit curious. Part of the talk, he just said, right, now everybody just sit now for 5 minutes and close your eyes and don't think about anything. And I tried to do it, and I wasn't trying to think about anything, but there were thoughts happening, and I got curious as to what happens there. You sit there, you don't think about anything, yet you do think. Who's doing it?
This is a Western Zen retreat that's going on at the moment. Can you describe the daily routine, what people do here every day?
Well, starting in the morning, we get up at 5 o'clock, and we...
You have those wonderful boards that go tap-tap, and you wake up.
Bang, and mallet on a piece of wood. And people wake up and get up, and then we go out in the yard and just do some simple stretching exercises, help people to wake up properly, a cup of tea, and then we come and sit and meditate quietly for about an hour, usually split into two portions of half an hour so people can stretch and move in between. We follow that with some chanting, and then we go on to have breakfast. About 7:30, I think.
I know by then, I've often had the experience of thinking, I feel as though I've been working hard for a whole day only 7:30 and breakfast
time. Yeah, well, after breakfast, you have a work period, and the same after lunch. And that's just simple things that need doing around a place, like chopping the vegetables ready for lunch, like chopping the wood ready for the fireplace, filling the oil lamps and replacing the burnt-out candles, sweeping the floors, those types of things, just to keep the place going. We have a walk in the middle of the afternoon, so we just go out on the hillside or something like that. After tea, usually have a talk and then some more meditation in the evening. Usually go to bed about 10 o'clock.
A long day.
Hmm.
It seems to me that it's a really tough undertaking. Do you think that's so?
It can be. It certainly can be, yes. Although I think people have got some interest and motivation to get here in the first place. It's quite a long way out of the way sort of place, and having made the effort to get here, they get on with it.
Have you ever had any wonderful experiences in meditation?
I've had all sorts of different things happen, really. Clarity, clearness, feeling more alive, perhaps.
Yes. Yes, feeling more alive. That's something about this place. I think I've had so much experience here of feeling more alive by letting go of stuff, by throwing it away. That really sort of rings a bell for me about this place, why it's important. You can come alive here, in spite of the horrors of what you're doing, this awful routine and this, you know, restrictions, you feel more alive. I first met John Crook when he was a psychology lecturer at Bristol University. I think before that he was an ethologist studying animal behaviour. He did a lot of watching birds, studying nest building and so on. And he also studied primates in Africa. Subsequently, of course, he was working more with human beings. And somehow or another he's managed to combine a Western academic intellectual way of life and discipline with an Eastern knowledge and training. And he's brought that together here in this house, which he bought and now runs as a Zen retreat house. How did you ever first come across meditation yourself?
I first came across it in a monastery in Hong Kong. And I happened to be passing what appeared to be an outhouse and peered in. And inside it, on a seat, there seemed to be a statue. When I looked more closely, it wasn't a statue, it was a Chinese monk, totally and utterly still, so still I could hardly see the breathing. And it so happened that that morning I had seen on the outside of a monastery gate the following words written: "There is no time. What is memory?" And so as I stood and looked at this figure, that question really, there is no time, what is memory? And I was very fascinated and wondered what on earth this man was really doing. And much later on, I actually started doing some meditation myself.
How? Where? Who taught you in the first place?
I went up to Samye Ling Meditation Centre in Scotland. It's a Tibetan centre. And this was in the sort of hippie days. It was a pretty wild place then. It wasn't kind of a fairly well-regulated Tibetan monastery as it is now. But there were some good monks there. And they didn't really teach me any meditation. I had a book and I'd read a bit about it. But what they did was, I think it was 8 times a day, a monk would go into the meditation room there, bang a gong, and everybody would sit in meditation for 1 hour straight. So I thought, I'll try this. And so for, I think it was about eight times a day, sat there for an hour and gave myself total hell. Tried to keep still. The first time I'd ever done it, body was in pain most of the time, and the head was full of thoughts, and it was really a wild trip. But after doing that about 4 days, I went out in the garden one day and the wind was blowing through my head.
So you got it suddenly, without the sort of help you give people to get them into it gradually.
Well, I wouldn't say that was a complete experience, but there was a definite shift in conscious awareness, which was deeply rewarding.
So tell me about the Myrtloid. How come we're all here and you have this retreat house?
Well, I spent some time in California, around about 68, 69. And when I came back, I was asked by my students and colleagues in Bristol University to run some of the kinds of events which were being done in California at that time. And my then wife and I had bought this place as a second home. It was a ruin, more or less. In fact, it was a cattle food store. The only thing good about the place was that the roof was on. Well, I began bringing small groups of people up to this ruin. And there are still people to this day who remember those early retreats, because there was no kitchen, there was no bogs, there was no running water. The roof was half off the barn, and yet we slept in sleeping bags in the barn. The conditions were wild and primitive, and we were doing this sometimes in the Welsh winter.
And what about now? How would you describe what you're doing now, 25 more years later?
Well, in the interval, I've trained quite a lot in Zen myself with a master, Master Sheng Yen, from Taiwan, and he has a center in New York, which I've been to quite a number of times and sat on retreats myself.
And you've been and sat in caves in the Himalayas and all sorts as well, haven't you?
Yeah, well, indeed, yes, Tibet is my other love. I mean, it's not only Chinese Chan. I've worked with both lamas and more particularly with yogins in the Himalayas. So I've picked up a lot about meditation, different kinds of meditation. And so what we offer here are fairly formal, quite strict, and by no means easy retreats in which, to sum it up in one word, people try to find out who they are. So it's essentially an exploration of inner silence, which of course isn't silent, because the thought makes a tremendous amount of noise. It takes several days before some degree of calm and insight into the quiet mind develops. People work together in pairs. And for example, supposing you and I were doing it, as I'm sure you have done, I would say to you, Sue, tell me who you are. And you would have 5 minutes, as you know, to make some kind of response to that. And note the words, a response, not necessarily an answer. And then after 5 minutes, a bell goes ping, and you say to me, maybe the same question to me, or it may be a different one. For example, it could be, tell me, how is life fulfilled? Or it could be, tell me, John, what is your true nature?
I remember it well. you say all this sort of rubbish for a bit, and it's amazing how quickly you run out. You say, oh, well, yes. My name's Sue Blackmore, and I do this, and I'm, you know, this is about where I was brought up. And you live wrong, but you run out of that. And then they're still staring at you and saying, tell me who you are.
Right,
I don't know.
No. One reaches something which is, we call it the desert. And then you really have to, as it were, hopefully go into another mode altogether, in which one might hear the wind blowing in the trees outside, or one might see a falling autumn leaf, or listen to the brook running, or the sheep baaing. And you begin to realize that all of those experiences are part of one's own awareness. And that is also oneself, that one isn't limited just to words and talk and gossip and prattle and fun and games. There's also that side of oneself which is silent, apperceptive listening.
But why here? Is this place special, or could we be anywhere? Could we be in a high-rise block in the middle?
You could be anywhere, yes. And in fact, these retreats are sometimes done just about anywhere. But there is a certain advantage about going to a remote spot in the countryside. It's quiet, you're a long way from anywhere else. You can go for walks in nature, which is almost wilderness. But the teaching in Zen is that you mustn't stay there. You have to go back into the hurly-burly of the marketplace after the retreat and find out what you learnt. It can only be tested in the marketplace. And I think that's very wise.
On a retreat, you're practicing being in the moment all the time, so you're not supposed to look forward to things, because you do find yourself looking forward to meals. And the meals on these retreats are superb. For many of the retreats I've been on, the cook has been Tim Blank.
That's the back kitchen. Keep all the food.
Pretty dark and gloomy, and of course there's no light.
No light, yeah. Can strike up a tilly lamp. There's what's left of the veg. If you'd come here a few days ago, it would have been full. But they've eaten it now.
So, no fridges?
No fridges, no.
What about milk?
Milk lives in the stream. It keeps it cool. Then this is the kitchen. It's the warmest room in the house, with the Roban.
You've got six kettles on there at the moment. How many people are here?
18.
And you cook for 18 people on that teensy little ancient Roban with six old-fashioned kettles boiling on the top.
Indeed, that and then the gas cooker as well.
Tell me a typical day as a cook on a retreat.
I get up first thing in the morning, and on this, which is a Western Zen retreat, means getting up at 5 o'clock. Kettle's on, and I come here and I put the porridge on and start cooking breakfast.
Oh, that porridge. I love... This is not normal porridge. Right. I love this porridge. It's got sort of raisins and seeds and I don't know what else. It's not like school porridge. No. Wonderful stuff.
I also put flour out and start getting ready to make bread. And then we have breakfast. Then after breakfast is a work period. And then I have a trusty load of helpers for chopping. You've done that enough times.
I have done it enough times, and I always appreciate the fact... I think the silence is very important to me on these retreats, and I sometimes get irritated by the people who just chat all the time. And I always appreciate it that you somehow make it possible for me to do all my chopping up of vegetables and stuff without having to speak and sort of break the habit of mind and concentration and so on.
Yeah, I don't like people yabbering. I'll stop them yabbering if they...
Do you? What do you do to stop them?
I just tell them to shut up. Lunch is always soup with rolls and cheese. And then after lunch, there's another work period. And then I'll normally make a cake.
Oh, I can see that. What's that delicious cake there?
It's the lemon cake. When Master Shen Yang came here, he introduced a dispensation where we were allowed to have cake in the afternoon on the charm retreats. So a little bit of austerity was
done away with,
and we were allowed cake. This place is a place of silence, and so I come here for the silence. I actually work with food outside of this place, buying and selling and processing and doing accounts and all that sort of thing with a large whole food distributor in Bristol. So it's a nice balance to actually come up here and cook where I'm actually hands-on with the food rather than just sitting on the telephone, do you want to buy a ton of beans, do you want to buy a ton of beans? So it's nice to actually have the beans, cook the beans.
I have stood there so many hours on retreats here with that gas lamp on the wall hissing away by my ear in the gloom, washing up, washing up, washing up. and actually come to love it. Simply just the process, moving the things with the water, the bubbles. When you've been meditating all day and then you come to wash up, it has become something, a pleasurable part of life, not something to be done and got through so I can get on with the rest of life, but something to do for itself.
It's very satisfying when you make a good meal. It's very acknowledging, because if I make a good soup, then although the dining room is completely silent, I know that I've done okay because the soup bowls are all empty. So I've often said that the Zen cook's job is to make an empty soup bowl. I mean, this has become a sort of home, very much a home. I mean, when I come here, especially in the kitchen, it's my home. It's a great, it's a nice home to come to. It's very comforting.
This is the living room. Flagstone floor has to be swept every morning, mats. Fireplace where there's the only heat in this place. I often wonder what it was like as a hill farm, a whole family living in this place. This room isn't used very much on the retreats, just for tea and occasionally passing through. But upstairs is the Buddha room, where in the old days, when it was a tiny place, we always used to meditate before there was the meditation hall. Now there's a little Buddha in there and you can sit quietly. I'm going to go and sit quietly. This is where I sat when I was on a retreat here on my own. I spent 5 days by myself. I just sat here many hours a day, put a rug down and a cushion. And our first bow, not for any reason, I'm not worshipping something. I think the bowing is more saying, here I am, thank you that it is this way, I accept that it is this way, and now I'm going to start. And when the bell sounds, well, just be here. And the thoughts come, let them go, whatever they are. That's it, really. One of the regulars on these retreats is very often the workmaster, James Monks, who's been coming here for years and years, and he's the one who tells you what to do.
Today, we've been up on the roof to try and repair a slate, which was gone. Found the whole thing was shifting slightly, so we got off quick, painting the bottom of the wonderful new composting privy with oil that will keep the weather out, and things like that.
What do you think is the relationship between the work and the sitting?
Work is love made visible. So, if you love, then you've got to express it some way.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it isn't my words, it's the words of Khalil Gibran, but in the way that a chair is made, it shows the love that the person put into it. And that is beautiful.
How did you ever first come here?
I don't know.
No, that's the wrong question. Not how, well, when, a simple question.
I came here years and years ago because some young woman with golden hair told me that she'd had a marvellous time here.
That's how you get all your meaningful experiences, is it?
It's a bit of an exaggeration. But I came because I thought that it sounded interesting, and I came and it was pretty powerful. I had this powerful experience of sitting with an impossible question and then finding a very strange and beautiful answer. Not here, but after I'd gone away on the way home.
Is that answer anything you can say anything about?
Oh, God, I think it's not really... not easily put into words for an audience, you know. But it was very beautiful and very powerful and very strange, and I collapsed in laughter.
At the
time.
And
since,
back.
Every time I think of it. And I wasn't sure whether I'd come again straight away, and it took some years to come again, and then since then, it's become a something of a habit.
There are a lot of people here who come back again and again.
Hmm.
What is it, do you think, that brings people back here?
Knowledge that this is a place where meanings of ordinary things can be found in an extraordinary way, which isn't normally available in our society. But it isn't really any different to how a society could be. It's just that it is a wild and beautiful place.
Is it just that? Could you go to any wild and beautiful place?
Well, it is special, but I mean, it is imbued with the attempts to work that have been left here, and traces of other people, and John's particular personal contribution.
Is this about something spiritual for you, James?
Well, yes, but I'm not making any distinction between spiritual and real in the worldly sense. But it isn't narrowly religious. It can't be confined within bounds.
Mm-hmm. I think that's part of its appeal to me.
Right.
I'm almost fiercely anti-religious in many ways.
Yeah, so am I. I mean, I wouldn't call myself a Buddhist any more than a Christian or something like that.
No, I wouldn't either. I don't.
But I have had an attempt at a Buddhist practice for years, and I seek that which is common, I think, to the aspirations of all men who seek beyond and within themselves.
It's getting dark now, and out of the little window I can see the mist in the valley down there, the lights coming on. Sometimes there's a kind of timelessness. I feel I've been here forever. Sometimes at this time of day, we do a chant, very simple chant. All it is, each person on their own says, in their own time, on any note they like, and they just keep doing that until they feel like stopping.
Place of Silence was presented by Susan Blackmore and produced in Bristol by Mary Ward Lowry.